We're going to talk about the scoliosis chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook, www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinion, Vayet. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. So today, we're doing a deep dive into adolescent idiopathic scoliosis, really drawing heavily from that Orthopedia chapter.
Great topic. Let's jump right in. What exactly are we defining when we say adolescent idiopathic scoliosis?
Okay, so scoliosis, fundamentally, it's a rotational deformity, right? Affects the spine in both the coronal plane that's looking front on and the sagittal plane, the side view.
Right. And those other words, idiopathic and adolescent, are crucial qualifiers.
Yeah, idiopathic meaning the cause is, well, unknown in these specific cases.
Exactly. No clear underlying reason we can pinpoint.
And adolescent just points to the typical age group we see this in.
Correct. And it's important to remember, like the chapter points out, that these terms mean there are other forms of scoliosis. Things like early onset scoliosis, which are covered elsewhere in Orthopedia, so we won't delve deep there today.
Good point. So let's nail down the criteria. What makes a diagnosis specifically adolescent idiopathic scoliosis, or AIS?
Okay, so Orthopedia lays out a few things. First, the age. The patient generally falls between 10 and 18 years old.
Right, the adolescent window.
Precisely. Historically, you had terms like infantile and juvenile, but now those earlier cases are often grouped as early onset scoliosis, which, again, is a separate discussion.
Okay, age is one criterion. What else?
Second, it has to be idiopathic. That means you've essentially ruled out other causes. No underlying spinal cord problems, no neuromuscular disorders like cerebral palsy or muscular dystrophy, and no congenital issues like malformed vertebrae present from birth.
So it's a diagnosis of exclusion in a way.
You could say that, yeah. And third, obviously there has to be scoliosis, a curvature of the spine.
Makes sense. Now, scoliosis means the spine isn't aligned. How do clinicians actually assess that alignment?
Right. Alignment is key. It's checked in both those planes, coronal and sagittal, typically using a plumb line dropped from the base of the C7 vertebra.
Okay, like a weighted string.
Exactly. So in the coronal plane, the front view, you're looking for neutral balance. That means the plumb line ideally falls right over the center of the sacrum, the base of the spine.
And if it doesn't?
If it falls to the left of the sacrum, that's called negative coronal balance. To the right, it's positive coronal balance.
Got it. What about the side view, the sagittal plane?
For sagittal balance, a neutral spine means that C7 plumb line just kisses the posterior superior corner of the S1 vertebra, the top part of the sacrum.
And deviations there?
If the line falls anterior to S1, that's positive sagittal balance. If it falls posterior behind S1, that's negative sagittal balance.
Okay, so we've defined it. We know how alignment's checked. How do we actually measure the curve itself? How big is it?
The magnitude. That's measured using the Cobb angle. It's the standard method.
The Cobb angle. How does that work?
First, you have to identify the end vertebrae. These are the vertebral bodies at the very top and very bottom of the curve that tilt the most into the curve.
Okay, the bookends of the curve.
Pretty much. Then you draw a line along the superior end plate, the top surface of the upper end vertebra, and another line along the inferior end plate, the bottom surface of the lower end vertebra.
And then?
You extend these lines until they intersect. The angle they form is the Cobb angle. Or, alternatively, you could draw perpendicular lines from those end plate lines and measure the angle where those intersect. It gives you the same value.
And if there's like an S curve, two curves.
Good question. Yeah, if you have offsetting curves like a main thoracic curve and a compensatory lumbar curve, you measure a Cobb angle for each one separately.
Right. So moving on to how this typically presents,
yeah.
What brings these patients or their parents into the doctor's office?
Often it's about appearance. The most common complaints are related to how the back looks. Things like a noticeable rib hump, especially when bending forward.
That asymmetry?
Yeah, or a trunk shift where the body seems shifted to one side or maybe uneven shoulders.
And these appearance issues, they can really affect someone, right?
Absolutely. The chapter notes, it can range from just mild unhappiness with appearance, a bit of dysphoria, all the way to, you know, really debilitating psychosocial distress for the adolescent.
That's important to remember. What about pain? Is AIS typically painful?
You know, it's classically described as painless,
but
we're seeing more low back pain reported in adolescents generally these days.
Yeah.
So pain might be present, but the scoliosis itself isn't automatically the culprit. That's a key point from Orthopedia.
Right. Correlation isn't causation there. Okay, let's pause for a quick reminder. we have been talking about the scoliosis chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook Orthopedia at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. So a big question for parents and patients is, does this get worse? Does adolescent idiopathic scoliosis progress?
Yes, it certainly can. The main driver for progression is growth. Scoliosis can worsen as the child grows taller.
So monitoring growth is critical.
Absolutely. Establishing their growth history and documenting growth at every follow-up visit is really fundamental.
When does growth typically stop?
On average, boys tend to stop growing around age 16 and girls around 14, or often it's timed as about 2 years after they start their periods after menarche. But these are just averages, of course.
Predicting remaining growth must be tricky then.
It is. It's one of the challenges. There are tools that help estimate skeletal maturity, like the Resser stage, which we can talk more about.
Okay, we'll come back to Resser. Let's talk physical exam. When a clinician is examining someone suspected of having AIS, what are they looking for?
They'll start with inspection. Just looking while the patient is standing naturally. They'll note any scapular prominence, shoulder blades sticking out unevenly, or asymmetry in the waist creases.
The waistline looking off kilter.
Yeah, or the space between the arms and the side of the body if that looks different side to side. Then they'll look from the lateral view, the side view, often looking for hypokyphosis.
Hypokyphosis, meaning less outward curve in the upper back than normal.
Correct. Less rounding in the thoracic spine than you'd typically expect. Then they'll observe and palpate, feeling for things like shoulder height asymmetry, confirming any trunk shift, and checking for a pelvic asymmetry or tilt.
You mentioned leg length discrepancy earlier. That's part of the exam too.
Definitely. It's crucial to identify a potential leg length difference because that can cause pelvic obliquity and mimic scoliosis or contribute to a curve.
How do they check if that's the cause?
A simple way is to place blocks of known thickness under the shorter leg until the pelvis levels out. If the spinal curve significantly corrects or disappears when the pelvis is level, then the leg length difference was likely the main driver, or at least a major contributor.
Okay. Are there any specific maneuvers or special tests used during the exam for AIs?
Yes. The key one is the Adams forward bending test.
How's that performed?
The patient stands with their feet together, knees locked straight, and bends forward at the waist like they're trying to touch their toes, letting their arms hang down.
And the examiner looks from behind.
Exactly. From behind, you're looking for any asymmetry in the rib cage or the shoulder blades. A rib prominence or hump on one side is a classic sign.
Can that hump be measured?
Yes, that's where a scoliometer comes in. It's basically like a small carpenter's level, often with a cutout to fit over the spine. You place it across the back at the point of maximum prominence during the Adams test, and it measures the angle of tilt or rotation.
Is there a cutoff value?
A common threshold used for referral or further investigation like x-rays is a rib prominence greater than about 7 degrees.
So 7 degrees on the scoliometer suggests something might be going on?
Yeah, it's a useful screening threshold.
Mm-hmm.
As a sort of rule of thumb, a 7-degree measurement on the Adams test often correlates roughly with a Cobb angle of maybe 10 to 20 degrees on an x-ray, though it's not a perfect correlation.
Got it. Now, you mentioned the Resser stage before as a tool for predicting growth. Can you explain that?
Sure. The Resser stage is a radiographic measure. You see it on an x-ray, usually of the pelvis. It assesses skeletal maturity based on how much the growth plate, or apophysis, on the top ridge of the iliac crest, the hip bone, has ossified or turned to bone.
How is it graded?
It's graded from 0 to 5. Resser 0 means there's no ossification center visible, yet lots of growth potential remaining.
And the higher numbers?
Resser 1 means the ossification covers up to the first 25% of the iliac crest, starting from the outside edge. Resser 2 is 25 to 50%, Resser 3 is 50 to 75%, and Resser 4 is 75 to 100%, meaning the ossification has reached the inner edge.
And Resser 5?
Resser 5 means the apophysis has not only fully ossified across the crest, but has also fused completely to the ilium. This signifies skeletal maturity, or very close to it. So higher Resser stages mean less growth remaining.
That seems like a really useful indicator for treatment planning.
It is, yeah. It helps gauge the risk of curve progression.
Okay, just to circle back quickly on the leg length discrepancy, how exactly does that cause an apparent scoliosis?
Right, so if one leg is shorter, the pelvis tilts down on that side to compensate when standing. This is called pelvic obliquity.
Makes sense.
To keep the head and the upper body centered over the pelvis for balance, the spine above the tilted pelvis has to curve in the opposite direction. This is a compensatory curve. It looks like scoliosis, but the primary issue is the pelvic tilt from the leg length difference.
Understood. Now, during the evaluation for AIS, are there any red flags clinicians look out for, things that suggest maybe it's not straightforward, adolescent idiopathic scoliosis?
Yes. The Orthopedia chapter lists several important ones. For instance, left-sided thoracic curves. Most idiopathic curves in the thoracic spine are right-sided. A left curve should prompt a closer look.
What else?
Significant pain, especially pain that wakes the patient at night. Also, apical kyphosis, meaning an excessive outward rounding at the peak of the scoliosis curve, which is uncommon in typical AIs.
Any others?
Rapid curve progression much faster than expected for their growth rate. Any structural abnormalities of the vertebrae seen on x-ray, like hemivertebrae or bars. Neurologic findings are a big one, things like abnormal reflexes, muscle weakness, numbness, tingling, or radicular pain shooting down a leg.
Okay.
And sometimes associated findings like certain foot deformities, like Kavivar's feet, or skin markings over the spine can also be red flags suggesting an underlying neurological or congenital issue.
So if those appear, it warrants a different kind of investigation.
Absolutely. Maybe imaging like an MRI of the spine to rule out underlying pathology.
Right. Let's shift to treatment then. What are the options for AIs and what determines the approach? What are the outcomes like?
Treatment really hinges on two main factors. The severity of the curve, measured by the Cobb angle, and how much growth the patient likely has remaining, often estimated using things like Risser stage and age.
Okay. What about prognosis after growth stops?
Yeah, that's important. After skeletal maturity, the general understanding is that curves less than 30 degrees are unlikely to progress significantly. However, curves greater than 50 degrees do tend to progress, maybe around 1 degree per year on average, though maybe faster during pregnancy or around menopause later in life.
So curve size at maturity matters for long-term stability.
It does. So for curves that are still relatively small, say less than 20 degrees, especially if nearing skeletal maturity, the probability of progression is low. Often surveillance until growth is complete is sufficient, and then they don't usually need close monitoring after that.
What about curves bigger than 20 degrees?
If a curve is over 20 degrees, and especially if the patient still has significant growth remaining, then intervention is often considered. The goal here is primarily to prevent further progression, not necessarily to make the curve perfectly straight.
And what's the main intervention for those moderate curves in growing kids?
Bracing. For curves typically between 20 or 25 degrees up to about 45 or 50 degrees, in patients who are still skeletally immature, bracing is the mainstay of non-operative treatment.
Is bracing effective?
Yes, there's good evidence now. The Orthopedia chapter mentions the BRACE trial, a major study. It found a significantly higher success rate, about 72%, in preventing curve progression to 50 degrees or more in the braced group compared to about 48% in the observation group. The trial was actually stopped early because bracing was shown to be so effective.
Wow, that's compelling.
It is. And major orthopedic societies like the Scoliosis Research Society, SRS, POSNA, AAAOS, even the AAP recommend bracing for appropriate patients based on this evidence.
Does the patient have to wear it a lot?
Yes, compliance is absolutely key. The effectiveness of the brace is directly related to the number of hours per day it's worn as prescribed. That can be a challenge for adolescents, understandably.
I can imagine. Okay, so bracing for moderate curves. When does surgery come into play?
Surgery is typically considered for larger curves, generally those greater than 45 or 50 degrees, especially if they're still progressing or are already large by the time of diagnosis near skeletal maturity. The goals of surgery are to correct the deformity significantly and, crucially, to halt any further progression by fusing the spine in the corrected position.
Is there a hard and fast rule for that 50-degree cutoff?
It's more of a guideline. The precise indication is still somewhat based on expert opinion and individual patient factors. The AAOS website, for instance, has guidance on this. Ideally, surgery is timed near skeletal maturity, if possible.
What do the surgical options actually involve?
Techniques have evolved and can vary, but the overall goal is deformity correction and achieving a solid spinal fusion across the levels of the curve.
What's a common technique now?
A very common modern technique is posterior spinal fusion, using pedicle screws and rods. Pedicle screws are placed into the vertebral bodies, and then long rods are attached to these screws to pull the spine into a more corrected alignment while the bone graft heals and fuses the vertebrae together.
And the outcomes are generally good?
Yes, surgery is usually successful in achieving significant correction and preventing further progression.
Are there potential complications, especially if done really young?
One potential issue particularly in very young patients with significant growth remaining, is something called the crankshaft phenomenon. If only a posterior fusion is done, the front part of the vertebral bodies, the anterior column, can sometimes continue to grow.
Leading to what?
This continued anterior growth, tethered by the posterior fusion, can cause the spine to rotate or twist over time, essentially recreating some deformity.
How is that prevented?
Often by trying to delay surgery until closer to skeletal maturity. Alternatively, in younger patients requiring surgery, surgeons might consider anterior spinal fusion techniques or combined anterior and posterior approaches to control growth across the entire spinal segment.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's wrap up by quickly reviewing those five key terms we've discussed, drawing from the Orthopedia chapter. First, just scoliosis again.
Right, scoliosis. Fundamentally, a rotational deformity of the spine, seen in both the coronal front and sagittal side planes.
Second, the Cobb angle.
Cobb angle.
Right.
The standard method for measuring the magnitude or size of the spinal curve on x-rays.
Third, Reiser stage.
Reiser stage.
Mm-hmm.
That radiographic assessment of the iliac crest apophysis, used to estimate remaining skeletal growth and predict progression risk.
Fourth, coronal balance.
Coronal balance refers to the alignment of the spine in the front-to-back view, assessed using that C7 plumb line relative to the sacrum.
And finally, the Adams forward bending test.
Adams test, the simple clinical screening test where the patient bends forward, allowing the examiner to look for rotational asymmetry, like a rib prominence indicative of scoliosis.
Excellent summary. And just a final reminder, these are really just the highlights from an incredibly detailed chapter in Orthopedia. For a full, comprehensive understanding, definitely check out the complete chapter over at www.orthopedia.com.
Absolutely. We have just discussed the scoliosis chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia. Orthopedia by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. Again, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us to read the book. You'll be glad you did.